In this segment, we will talk about the two remaining types of basic clinical questions concerning harm and prognosis. So let's start with discussing the use of evidence-based medicine to assess questions about harm or etiology. What causes a disease? Now, diseases may be caused by things in the air or water, bacteria, chemicals, radiation from the sun, or they may also be caused by things that we do, such as a medical intervention that has a complication. The primary issue with assessing harm or etiology is not whether someone who gets exposed to some kind of agent gets ill, but rather those who have that illness have had a higher rate or amount of exposure. So for example, just because someone who uses a cell phone gets brain cancer doesn't necessarily mean that the cell phone causes brain cancer, and in fact we'll look at that specific example. Well, the ideal way to actually assess harm is to do a randomized controlled trial. If we think that some chemical causes cancer, the best thing to do would be to get a bunch of people together and randomize half of them to getting exposed to the chemical and half of them not. Obviously, that's unethical, so we can't do that. So we need other kinds of study designs that enable us to detect whether something causes harm. So we have to go down to the next best level of evidence, which is observational studies, and we have to be careful in how we interpret observational studies to ensure that they answer our questions. So here's examples of questions that have come up in the news media about whether things cause harm. So certainly in the mid and early 1990s, there was the issue of whether silicone breast implants cause autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And it was definitely true that some women who had implants developed these diseases, which are commonly called connective tissue diseases, and also arthritis. But they didn't develop them at a higher rate than those who did not have breast implants. So silicone breast implants do not appear to cause these autoimmune diseases, despite many lawyers who believe to the contrary. Another question that came up in the 1990s was whether a number of anti-obesity drugs on the market at the time, like Fen-Phen, cause problems like heart valve abnormalities. And it turned out that those who used the drugs actually did develop certain heart abnormalities at a higher rate than those who did not have the abnormalities. So when we're assessing studies of harm, we essentially have a hierarchy of evidence, and a randomized controlled trial will be best. And oftentimes we can use a randomized controlled trial to determine harm. We'll actually look at some of the results again from the Women's Health Initiative. Obviously they didn't set out to show that hormone replacement therapy caused harm, but that's what they discovered. The next best study is a cohort study, followed by a case control study and a case series or an individual case report, the weakest form of evidence. So let's look at these different kinds of studies. So again, a randomized controlled trial would often be ideal, but often it can't be done or it would be unethical to do it. So let's look at some lesser forms of evidence, and these types of studies can also be used to assess things like interventions, but typically with interventions we demand a randomized controlled trial. Well, one other type of study is a cohort study. This is where we have a prospective study, so we do take a group of patients who get exposed to something and follow them forward in time, but we don't randomize them. Now, it turns out that cohort studies can be useful when poor outcomes are pretty rare, such that a huge sample size would be required. So, for example, upper GI hemorrhage, upper GI bleeding that occurs with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Motrin and Naproxen and, until it was taken off the market, Vioxx. It turns out that this complication is relatively rare. We see it in clinical practice because so many patients take these drugs, but the rate of GI bleeding from NSAID drugs is actually relatively low. And in fact, it's difficult to do a clinical trial to detect that. So a cohort study can help us in a situation where these poor outcomes are rare. Of course, they're problematic when the groups aren't really similar. So, for example, if we follow a cohort of people and we compare those who take the drugs, the NSAID drugs, versus those who don't, they're obviously different people. Those who take the NSAID drugs are more likely to have ongoing medical problems, particularly those that require the NSAID drugs. So we don't get that benefit of randomization. Another type of study is a case control study. This is actually the most common form of observational study, and it's certainly the most common type of study that's done in when we're assessing harm. And of course, a lot of times we find out or we suspect that something is harmful and we want to find out as quickly as possible. We can't do a prospective study because it might take years to find out, so we want to look retrospectively. So what we do is we identify cases of disease, so people who develop the disease that we think is caused by the harmful agent, and then we match them to controls. That's why it's called a case control study. And then we look at the two groups, those who have the cases and those who have the controls, and we see if there's a different rate or amount of exposure. And that, for example, enabled us to see that there wasn't a higher rate of use of breast implants in patients, for example, with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. So similar to cohort studies, case control studies can be useful when the condition is rare. It can also be useful when the condition has a long development time. And in fact, that's how it was determined that the drug DES, which was taken off the market in the 1950s, causes vaginal cancer in women. Now, one of the problems with case control studies is that they can create spurious associations. And a case in point was a study that came out when I was a medical student and was quite controversial at the time. And this study purported to detect a linkage between coffee consumption and pancreatic cancer. And this study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so it certainly carried the prestige of that journal. But it turns out that they used the wrong control group, which shows you that sometimes even in the best of journals, bad science can get through. But what they did was they, as control subjects, they used people who had other GI diseases. And many of those GI diseases have symptoms that are exacerbated by coffee, particularly gastroesophageal reflux. So those who have these other diseases drink less coffee. So when you use them as a control group of cases versus those with pancreatic cancer, the pancreatic cancer people drink more coffee, but the coffee is not the cause of their cancer. They drink more coffee because they can tolerate it better. And in fact, when this study was repeated with an appropriate control group over a decade later, that association was disproven, and those of us who drink coffee could rest assured that we were not causing pancreatic cancer in ourselves. The lowest form of evidence is the case series, or even worse, the single case report. And of course, the reason why this is the lowest form of evidence is there's no comparison group. Now, a case series can be used to generate a hypothesis that would then be tested with more rigorous study designs, but a case series or a case report in and of itself is not considered to be high quality evidence. And a classic example of this is the drug Bendectin that came out in the 1980s as treatment for nausea in pregnancy. Now, we should always be careful about giving any medication to pregnant women, but it turns out that Bendectin was probably unfairly singled out, and in fact the adverse publicity was so strong that it was taken off the market, and some women actually benefited. And one of the ingredients of Bendectin was actually a vitamin. But Bendectin was a combination of two agents, both of which were known to be effective, and neither of which had any harm, but because there was a case series of birth defects, Bendectin was taken off the market and actually depriving women with nausea of pregnancy an effective treatment. Well, let's make a few comments about prognosis. One of the important things to know about prognosis is that it's actually hard to do a good prognosis study, because prognosis is the natural history of a disease, how the disease actually unfolds. But in this day and age, there's very little in the history of a disease that's natural. Almost every disease we intervene in, whether we do diagnostic tests, and certainly all the interventions we do, the potential harm that we cause. And many studies actually end up measuring prognosis after some form of test or intervention. So we may measure prognosis for a group of patients that have been diagnosed with a certain condition. Or we may measure prognosis for a group of individuals who have been treated for something. When we start to do that, the differences between a prognosis study and a treatment study start to blur a little bit. The most common way that we measure prognosis is with a survival curve. We looked briefly at survival curves in the context of the Women's Health Initiative. So this, for example, is a survival curve from one type of cancer when it's diagnosed at different stages. And like many cancers, the worse the stage of the cancer, the worse the prognosis. Those having stage one of this particular cancer have a good prognosis. Those having stage four have all died within 7 years. So here's some example studies. There have been several prognosis studies recently coming out from children who were extremely preterm, extremely low birth weight, and in neonatal intensive care units. There are a number of ethical and philosophical issues about how much intervention in these extremely small children is desirable, and a prognosis study gives us an indication of how they do, especially in this case 6 years out. So this one study followed a cohort of 241 children from the UK and Ireland who were born at 25 or fewer weeks gestation, so extremely preterm. They were actually compared with classmates in their schools who were born at full term. And the differences were substantial. 41% of the preterm children had serious impairment on a variety of cognitive tests compared with 1.3% of their full-term classmates. Another study of prognosis has recently was published on prostate cancer, particularly untreated early localized prostate cancer. So this is a group of men who were diagnosed between 1977 and 1984 and had very nice long-term follow-up. Of course, in this day and age, many of them would have gone to surgery, but this gives us an indication of the natural history of the disease. And about 17% of these men developed generalized disease. In other words, the cancer spread, metastasized to other areas. And 16% of these men died of the disease. So this is just another indication that many men develop prostate cancer and don't die from it, and it doesn't even spread outside their prostate. And so we have to take that into account when thinking about treatment and screening and so forth.